So what are you doing here?
Couple of things. Taking a break from my wife, forgetting my son's birthday, and getting paid $2 million to endorse a whiskey when I could be doing a play somewhere.
Oh.
But the good news is the whiskey works. What are you doing?
My husband's a photographer, so he's here working. And I wasn't doing anything, so I came along. And we have some friends that live here.
How long have you been married?
Oh, thank you. 2 years?
25 long ones.
Mm. You're probably just having a midlife crisis. Did you buy a Porsche yet?
You know, I was thinking about buying a Porsche.
In 25 years, it's impressive.
Well, you figure you sleep 1/3 of your life. That knocks off 8 years of marriage right there. So you're down to 16 and change, and you know, you're just a teenager at marriage. You can drive it, but there's still the occasional accident.
Yeah.
What do you do?
I'm not sure yet, actually. I just graduated last spring.
What did you study?
Philosophy.
Yeah, there's a good buck in that racket.
Yeah. Welcome to The Cinematologists. I'm Neil Fox, and with me as ever is Dario Linares. Hi, Dario.
Hey, Neil. How are you?
I'm well. I'm better than you, I think, if the rumours are true.
Yeah, you know, because that sounds really weird, but we'll press on. Yeah. I had a little bit of a bicycle accident, little crash, and dislocated my shoulder. So I've been off work for a couple of weeks now, and I've got a couple of more weeks. I'm in this very cumbersome brace that holds my arm at a kind of perpendicular angle. So it's, you know, really difficult for dressing and eating and all that functional kind of stuff. So
yeah, it looked brutal. The conversations we've had suggest that it's a painful scenario you got yourself there.
Well, yeah, it was quite interesting because the combination of the morphine and other drugs, and then doctors trying to reposition it. They call it kind of like manipulating, but what they really mean is pulling it as hard as they can in the direction it doesn't want to go. At the same time as half watching and listening in the hospital to Donald Trump winning the election. So it was a kind of delirious few days altogether, really.
I'll bet, yeah. And when you came round from your morphine haze, he was actually the president, so...
Yeah, and then I got diarrhea, so, you know, the journey was complete, I think.
Wow. You have had a terrible week.
Thank you.
So we're back. We've had a little bit of a break from these episodes. We were scheduled to have an episode on Keir Starmer and a screening of Close Up, but we had to cancel that screening on the day of the screening because my partner went into labour 2.5 weeks early, which was massively inconvenient, obviously, but wonderful. So
yeah, but congratulations on that. And you know, if there's any excuses to circumvent a cinematologist screening, then we'll give you that one.
Yeah, that's pretty much, you know, the only thing I would miss a screening for is the birth of my firstborn. But yes, so Tessa is now just over a month old. Mum and baby doing very well, very happy. I think it's what's interesting is you've been kind of curtailed from sort of day-to-day life, but being able to watch a lot more films. I've found myself in a position of kind of spending most of my time just holding a sleeping infant. So what we've been doing is watching a lot of films as well, just while she kind of sleeps. So people sort of say, oh, you don't watch any movies after the baby's arrived, but I've seen more in the last month than I have in the previous three. So
fantastic. Well, yeah, I mean, obviously it's great to having a completely silent screening partner.
Yep, and I'm kind of preparing a well, so we have watched Keir Starmer and nothing but the best. nothing but the best for the child. So today we're back with a screening that you hosted down in Hastings, a new venue that we were working with. Today's film is Sofia Coppola's Lost in Translation.
Yeah, we were screening this at the Kino in St. Leonard's, which is a sort of fantastic new-ish venue for theatre and film. And there's a restaurant there and there's a Russian art gallery. It's a sort of incredible space, to be honest with you, and we're hoping to do more events there in the future. In fact, I'm hoping to get a more contemporary screening with the filmmaker down in the new year. But yeah, hopefully more screenings there. We haven't left behind any of our other venues like the Electric Palace. We are back at the Electric Palace soon, but it's nice to have these different venues to go to. And I was very delighted to be joined on stage by Melody Bridges, who is a writer, a filmmaker, theatre director, and she runs the Worthing Festival as well. So she came all the way from Worthing to introduce the film with me.
Yeah, and I've been listening into the recordings, I think things are really, really interesting kind of set of conversations that came out of that. So I think there's a lot to talk about today. And I think it's going to be a really kind of different kind of episode, I think, in terms of the way we talk about the film. So, and then in the middle, we've got an interview that I did that I kind of stole from under you that you set up, but you couldn't do because of your injury.
Yeah, I got in contact with Violet Luca, who is the digital editor of Film Comment. So the Film Comment magazine and the Film Comment podcast. And as listeners will know, we always try to big up other podcasts on film that we like. And Film Comment is one of our particular favourites. And there's certain episodes on the Film Comment podcast that we really have rated over the last few months. And yeah, it was just great to sort of contact Violet on Twitter. And she agreed, fantastically, she agreed straight away to do an interview. And then I fell off my bike, so you swooped in there to do the interview. But it was a really good, really fascinating conversation, lots of areas covered. And in fact, we have an extended version of the interview, which is on our website. So we've cut this. This is about 25, 26 minutes, the interview we've got on today's episode. There is a 45-minute extended version with yourself and Violet, which will be up on the website in due course.
Yeah, and it was a real pleasure to be able to step in and talk to Violet, because you're right when you sort of say that it's a podcast and a publication that we hold in high esteem. And it was at the end of a week of a kind of very crazy and kind of depressing week in many ways. It was nice to be able to engage with someone about film and kind of all the things around it. So hopefully people will enjoy that. Seeing as that's a long interview in the middle and we have a lot to talk about around the film, let's go now to the introduction at the Kino of Lost in Translation.
Thank you very much. We even got a whoop there, which I was quite impressed by. Welcome to the Cinematologist podcast. Thanks very much for coming. This is our first screening at the fabulous Kino Teatro in St. Leonard's. I didn't want to go down the Russian accent route there. Thanks very much to James and the rest of the team here for hosting us for this event, where tonight we're going to screen Sofia Coppola's 2003 drama Lost in Translation, starring Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson. And I'm very pleased to welcome our special guest presenter tonight, who is Melody Bridges. And Melody is a playwright, an actress, filmmaker, festival director of Worthing's WOW Festival, and now a contributing editor to a new book entitled Silent Women, Pioneers of Cinema. Melody, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Great. First of all, what do you think of this amazing venue? What a great place.
It is a stunning space. They've obviously spent a lot of time and energy renovating this and making it a really special place in Hastings. And I haven't actually ever been here before, so I'm very happy to make it here tonight.
Absolutely. And it's got a sort of old school, almost sort of Berlin vibe, hasn't it, going on? Sort of theatre, and you expect cabarets to be taking place. But fantastic for cinema, of course, as well.
It does. I think it seems like a space that people who really love cinema would love to come to, because you can relax, enjoy a drink with the bar, and enjoy the movie too.
So before we get into the film, I thought we could just mention your book, which I have here. I nearly said it's available in all good bookshops, but that was back in 1993. But it's a collection of essays about the contribution of that women made to early film history. And on reading it, I think the interesting part for me to begin with is that the jumping off point of the book is that in the very early days of cinema, there was much more women employed right across the film industry than there are now. You know, there was almost sort of 50-50 participation with women in the film industry.
Yes, that's absolutely right. The film kind of came up, the book came about because I was really surprised to find that out myself, and then I felt more people need to know that. And then I said to the publisher, let's do a book about it, and she said, okay, yeah, let's do that. So that's how that happened. I'm very much a kind of accidental publisher. I much more see myself as a filmmaker and a director, and I stumbled into the world of writing, really, for books, and had written a chapter about being a female filmmaker, and that's how I knew the publisher in the first place. And we were promoting that book, and so we were at this talk, and this expert in the early days of cinema was saying, well, of course, we all know that there were many more women filmmakers in the early days of cinema than now. And I had thought before I heard that, that I knew a lot about cinema, and hearing that actually completely changed my concept of cinema, and it made me realise that I really didn't know, A, I didn't know as much as I thought I did, and B, I thought this is a really important story, and it's a story that needs to be shared, it needs to be discussed, you know, who were these female filmmakers, why don't we know them now, and what does it say about women today in the film industry who perhaps aren't widely enough recognised or acknowledged? Mm.
Yeah, there were so many fascinating figures at that time. I mean, reading about the director, Alice Guy Boucher, when a lot of her films, she made so many films, and in a way she kind of invented the concept of direction as we know it today.
Yes, some people say that she's not only the first female director of narrative cinema, but the first director officially in some ways. So the idea that she made 1,000 short films, the idea that there were a number of women who were really very key in the early pioneer days of cinema, it's very exciting to kind of find that out, and also really, really important in 2016 for us to think about what that means now, because it means that you think you can have that space, you can have that acknowledgement, and it means that it allows, hopefully, women filmmakers, young filmmakers today, to feel that they have the right to be sharing their story and their vision.
And it's obvious that the importance of women filmmakers is something that's kind of come up in popular discourse, you know, a lot more clearly in the last few years, I think, with filmmakers and actresses sort of, you know, talking about various issues about not just payment and things like that, but actually how they're treated in the film industry and the opportunities. But do you think it's also about, it's not just about the number of films that get made by women, but it's also about the representations and the types of stories that are told?
It's complex because I think those two issues are very much interwoven. People think that if there were more women directors and more women screenwriters, then maybe the shift of how the stories we saw in the world would be more representative of our world, perhaps. Yeah. Just as there are a great lack of films that are championed by people of colour. Mm. So the idea is that it's a kind of issue about diversity generally and about giving people the right to have their story.
Sure.
So yeah, it's very much ingrained with issues about power in our society, stereotypes of who gets to tell their stories and what kind of stories those people are interested in.
Yeah, and obviously tonight's film, we've got a female director, not by any coincidence at all. And this is probably her most well-known film, I would say. Maybe The Virgin Suicides or Marie Antoinette. And in a way, she's a filmmaker, I think, who is interested in how situations affect people. You know, I don't know how many people have seen the film already. I mean, I assume most people have here. But that idea of the context of a relationship, where it's situated, and it's not just that they're in a specific location, as in Japan, but they're in different stages of their lives, the two main characters. And she's also somebody who's thought of as kind of chronicling the millennial experience. And maybe we can talk later, you know, after the film about how autobiographical this is. But what's your take on Sofia Coppola? What kind of a filmmaker is she for you?
I think what's good about Sofia Coppola is it shows that women filmmakers have the right to be mediocre.
Right, okay.
and I think that's really important because I think that we should We need filmmakers across the spectrum to be allowed to succeed and to fail. And we need them to have the chance to have their voices. This is actually, I think, a very Marmite film. Okay. Some people really love it, and some people think it's extremely racist.
Okay.
So I think it'll be very interesting to hear back from afterwards from the audience what the audience's perception of it as a film is. Yes, it's a female filmmaker. Does it make it a feminist film? Some people would say just the very action of a woman taking on that responsibility and that visionary creative director role is a feminist act. So yes, it's a female film, it's a feminist film. But if you're looking at the story, which obviously she wrote, then you know it'll be interesting to hear. Again, I'll be curious to hear what the audience response afterwards is as to whether you think the actual storyline and the plot is a feminist one.
And there's certain scenes as well that really kind of are, you could really criticise them in various different ways. And it's not just the ways in which Scarlett Johansson is photographed in certain ways. If it was a man doing it, there would be an awful lot of criticism as well. So, yeah, it would be interesting to see what the audience thinks about that. In a way, though, it's also seen as a film, Lost in Translation is seen as a film that is sort of characteristic of alienation, let's say, in the 21st century. You know, so people at different stages of their lives and not really knowing where they are and therefore kind of who they are. And in a way, you know, this, I suppose, is the main theme of the film. Is that something that you got from it, without giving too much away, of course?
Yes, well, I guess without giving too much of it away, yeah, absolutely. The concept of alienation, loss, not knowing where you are, it's very much a 21st century kind of film about, yeah, loneliness. And I think the title itself is actually fantastic, The Lost in Translation, that sense of being a kind of in an alien landscape.
Yeah.
So in that perception, it's quite an interesting film.
Yeah, but it's also kind of like I think it's the translation of relationships as well, how when we're communicating with each other, sometimes that communication is lost in various ways, and how they kind of slowly come to know each other, these two characters. They're building that sense of communication, and I suppose across time, I suppose.
I think that's nice. I think that's a really good point. And I think you see a lot of relationships, interesting relationships going on with our two key characters, obviously, but also with the other people. You know, obviously, the Scarlett Johansson character also has a husband there,
yeah,
and her relationship with him. And Bill Murray has the hectoring wife down the phone,
sure,
who is taking care of his children.
I mean, it's interesting that. I mean, we'll run the film in a second, but just as a last point, it does, of course, star Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson. And obviously, the relationship between the two kind of replicates one of the cliches of Hollywood with the older man and the younger women. But do you think that Sofia Coppola uses this familiar dynamic and actually pushes it somewhere new, or kind of undermines or plays with the obvious cliche?
It is obviously that big age gap. It is a significant age gap. It's something that's interesting to explore. Yeah, I would say that there's one key scene that really disappoints me.
Okay.
But maybe we'll come back to that afterwards.
Yeah, don't give
we're not
that
allowed
away.
To.
Yeah. Okay, wonderful. So, yeah, let's get on with it. Let's put on Lost in Translation.
Welcome to New Tokyo International Airport, Narita.
Okay, so I think Melody definitely raised some interesting points there, Neil. What did you make of that?
I thought that, yeah, I mean, I think it was a great intro and really kind of set the tone for a chance to get into the film in a variety of different ways. This idea of the need for there to be mediocre filmmakers, I think, is a fascinating one, and one I've never really heard kind of phrased that way or thought about in that way. And I think it's absolutely spot on. And, you know, we accept the mediocrity of hundreds of male filmmakers. What I would ask, though, is And what I wondered when I was listening to Melody's kind of introduction is, are there any other female filmmakers who would be allowed to get away with being so mediocre if they weren't a Coppola? Does that name allow Sofia Coppola the same amount of passes that a male filmmaker would have because of her heritage? And I know that she has a lot of champions and a lot of admirers, and a lot of people would argue that, you know, that her work has a significant amount to say. But I think Melody's right. There is a feeling of mediocrity that kind of runs through it, particularly after Lost in Translation. I mean, I pretty much don't like anything after this. I think there's something about her first couple of films which are tonally and kind of atmospherically really ethereal and interesting, and kind of conjure a feeling out of place and space and tone that just doesn't seem there in the rest of her work. But I do wonder if she's afforded opportunities that to kind of fail or find her voice over a significant amount of films that wouldn't be afforded to other filmmakers, female filmmakers.
Yeah, I think the nepotism question is something that's been raised time and time again, and you know, you can make of that what you want. But I do tend to agree with you, Neil, that the films that come after Lost in Translation are of diminishing returns, let's say. I mean, I know a lot of people do like Marie Antoinette, and that has... I was just reading an article by Slate from back in 2010 that talked about how much of a polemic filmmaker she is, and I do think you're right, she has got champions. But yeah, I mean, this afternoon I watched Somewhere, which was just dire, really. I mean, it was really kind of self-indulgent, and I know that Lost in Translation is about Hollywood, and this is another film that's kind of like about being in that Hollywood bubble and the sort of alienation of that, and clearly she has a grasp of that world. But you know, it was really tedious to watch and didn't have any of the kind of chemistry between Stephen Dorff and Elle Fanning is in it, and they're both kind of all right, but there's no development and chemistry of this sort of father-daughter relationship, which is obviously mimicking a little bit the Bill Murray Scarlett Johansson relationship. But then, you know, you've got The Bling Ring I tried to watch, and I think I got half an hour in and just turned it off. I just couldn't be bothered. So she's probably one of the few, if maybe even the only female filmmaker who would have been given these chances time and time again because clearly of the production backing that she has.
Yeah, I think it's... I mean, I admire Marie Antoinette, you know, and I think that what it's trying to do is kind of bold and fascinating. I just don't think it works. You know, I don't have a problem with a filmmaker trying to engage formally or, you know, or kind of stylistically in that way. And I wouldn't presume to criticize it, but it feels to me like that had such an impact that she has kind of retreated into too close to her own experience and her own kind of milieu, that Lost in Translation is really helped by taking those characters out of their comfort zone. And in Somewhere in the Bling Ring, those characters who are kind of unlikable exist in their own bubble, and there's no tension because they're not stepping outside geographically outside of that. So it's very hermetically sealed and very airless experiences, I found, in a way that Lost in Translation is and Virgin Suicides are not. But then, you know, I think that it's... I certainly wouldn't want to see her stop making films, you know, because I think that if she can find that kind of that interesting space that she found in her early films again, you know, that she's a technically very gifted filmmaker, you know, and I love her pacing, and I love the bravery of just sticking to her guns narratively, and I kind of like the way she constructs films, which we'll probably talk a little bit about later on, because there's some things I wanted to raise about what the audience sort of said and about kind of Lost in Translation character and stuff like that. So yeah, it's just it was just when I heard Melody sort of say that, I thought that's such an interesting point, which I think is has a lot more. There's a lot more to talk about there as.
Yeah, and clearly we arranged this screening and the guests today with an eye and an ear to talking about women filmmakers generally, and obviously it's kind of difficult when it's just us guys to sort of profess on this in a way. But I mean, I think it's an interesting question that we were just sort of thinking about before, about is there a sort of precondition that perhaps the likes of us have when we go into a film knowing that it's a female filmmaker? Do you think that there's a sort of almost this kind of unconscious gender politics that plays out in the mind, in the sense of looking for something specific when it's a female filmmaker?
It's a big question, isn't it? It's a big, tough question. I'd like to think not in our, in our case, you know, but I think that female filmmakers are unfairly expected to be political, you know, and I think that a lot of that comes down to what Melody was saying there about that there's no spectrum of female filmmakers where there's just female filmmakers making films like that being that Hollywood is churning out regularly. Like, so there's less work to draw from and it's more pointed. And I think that that is something that kind of almost happens kind of collectively, maybe if individuals don't kind of go in that way, there is kind of an expectation. But then I think it's an expectation, an assumption made about filmmakers of colour as well. They will that their work will be ideologically, you know, driven towards issues of race. And I think that it's absolutely ridiculous to expect that of filmmakers, because simply because we don't expect it of white men. And if it's that way for one group of people making films, it should be that way for all of them. And I think that sometimes, if you know, someone like Sofia Coppola, is her films, they collapse under the weight of an expectation that there's a politics in them, you know. And I don't think particularly Lost in Translation has that kind of politics in it. I think it has a lot of questioning of existence and humanity from a very, very particular context. But I don't think it's striving to be a political film at all. And I think its pleasures are elsewhere in the way that other filmmakers would be given credit for, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a sort of couple of things out of that. I mean, the first one is that sort of sense that, you know, there's a weight of expectation around a female filmmaker as to what the feminist politics are going to be, if you see what I mean. And then there's almost a sort of implication that female filmmakers are obliged to deal with that topic, you know what I mean, at all times, as it were. And yeah, it's, I think that's really kind of unfair. But then also, I think the other thing that really kind of, that I can see is a real, you know, a real sort of offshoot of, you know, the patriarchy of film culture, if you want to call it that, which is the way in which female filmmakers are defined as female filmmakers, as almost as a caveat. So two of the filmmakers, female filmmakers, again, I hate saying it, but in a way, in the context of the discussion, you kind of have to. But Kelly Reichardt, who we've screened a film of, and we've you know, talked about an awful lot as being somebody we think should be in the, you know, the pantheon of those names that are listed in terms of American filmmakers who are right up there. And then for me as well.
There was an interesting piece in The Guardian about that the other day. I don't know if you saw it.
Oh, right. No,
about
no,
working class films. You know, that there are a lot of films that are made about working class Americans, but they're not taken seriously because they're about women by women. So,
yeah.
You know, if people are listening, it's definitely worth checking that out because Kelly Reichardt falls into that. You know, they talk about Reichardt in the piece. So. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, and it's fine. And the other filmmaker is Ava DuVernay, who I really liked Selma. Like, for example, an awful lot more than Lincoln. I think it's a far superior film to that.
Agreed,
and
the latest documentary
is probably as good a kind of conventional documentary as I've seen. I mean, it's really powerful stuff, the 13th. But then again, you know, watching American Honey, I don't know, have you seen American Honey?
I haven't seen
yet?
American Honey yet, no.
Right, I mean, I'd be really interested to see what your take is on that, because again, that is a film that I think that a lot of people are, or it's splitting people, let's say. And I like it a lot up to a certain point. But I think it's, you know, it's kind of doing a hell of a lot more than, say, The Bling Ring does in a, you know, within the same kind of ballpark, I suppose. But yeah, it's that caveat of, oh, this is a great film by a female filmmaker is almost like that naming is always a kind of problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's an oppressive system that names work in that way in order to highlight the inferiority or the lack of space or the, you know, this kind of perceived privilege or superiority. It's weaponized, you know. It's an absolute weapon used by the patriarchy to, you know, there's absolutely no, you know, just thinking of the films I've seen recently, yeah, 13th is astonishingly powerful and kind of beautifully constructed in terms of the way it serves the purpose of the film. Mia Hansen loves Things to Come, Rachel Lang's Baden-Baden, Athena Rachel Sangari's Chevalier. You know, they're the best films I've seen this year by amazing filmmakers. And that's it. That's enough, you know. But you cannot see their work discussed without that kind of parentheses at the front that they are women. And it's just absolutely... I do struggle to think why, you know, there's no other reason why we're still talking about this other than it's a toxic weapon of undermining, you know, which is just ridiculous. So that seems like a good point to move on to our interview with Violet Luca, the digital editor of Film Comment. I sort of mentioned that you were the digital editor of Film Comment. What exactly is the digital editor, and what does the digital editor do?
Well, it's sort of a bit of a misnomer, but so what I do is basically I flow anything that you see on the website, you know, all of the text, all of the images, I enter that. I'm the one who's doing the layout on that. I'm the one who's putting that in. I rarely, if ever, edit something. Like, that's really, you know, more of like Nicholas Rapold, who's the current editor of Film Comment, or Michael Koreski, or Laura Kern. They're the ones who are actually sort of editing copy that is sent to us, and then I'm one laying it out. I also lay out the everything that goes in the app, so reflowing 96 pages of a magazine into another format. And I do all the social media. I do the podcast, obviously. I do... just like basically anything that's involves a computer, that sort of falls to me. Yeah.
How much of your time is spent kind of, you know, doing the editorial work, and how much is spent kind of actually writing? Because obviously, you know, you just had a piece out, and is it, if it feels like it's, you know, quite an organic place to work, it doesn't seem to be kind of a strict quota or anything, but do you find yourself kind of having any kind of balance between being a sort of a writer and an editor?
I mean, I would like to write more. It's always something, it's always you know, it's just finding the time, and it's like, you know, there's a lot of admin involved in just sort of like running a magazine. So I don't always, and a website. And so I don't always have time to do it actually at the office. I think the office is probably one of the worst places you could try to write. So I try to, you know, I'm trying to sort of pick that up again. So I would say balance is not great.
Would you describe yourself as a critic or a film reviewer? This is something that we've been sort of asking over the last couple of episodes, and just wondered where you sort of saw yourself as a, you know, if you were to give yourself a label, which would be horrible, but, you know, would you class yourself as a critic or a reviewer, do you think?
Probably a critic, because I mean, there are just certain weeks where it's like, I mean, I was writing weekly for a while this year, and I just sort of, I mean, I got super busy because we were in the final sort of stretch of developing and testing the app. But also just because it's sort of like nothing new is worth writing about. Like, what is, I mean, you know, like, for, I'll give you a perfect instance of like Suicide Squad. It's like that movie was sort of analyzed to death before it came out. And I wanted to write about it because I actually bothered to see it. And it is kind of fascinating in a weird sort of train wreck way. And I don't know. It's just, there didn't seem a point because everyone had already said most things that you could really say about it. And so it's like, well, I don't just sort of want to add to voices. And I think maybe reviewers sometimes sort of fall into that trap as opposed to a critic. I'd rather focus sort of like on ideas rather than, is this good? Is this bad?
There's something about Film Comment and the kind of the work that you put out, which kind of feels like a resistance to what Dario has called the fascism of immediacy, or that's what he's put on the questions he's asked me to ask, you know. So is that a conscious kind of reaction? Because it seems like some of the stuff that you know, that you read, particularly through the website, is almost a kind of reaction to, you know, to the culture. But also it's finding that balance, because obviously you've made a lot of kind of changes to the magazine. You've got this app. It's a difficult balance, isn't it, to try and retain the integrity of of a publication like Film Comment, but also stay relevant and stay in the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, basically when I was hired, Film Comment was very barely online. You know, it was sort of like there would be one or two articles from the magazine that would go up of a feature, of a review of anything. And so, you know, a lot of what I've done is to try and be respectful of basically just being skeptical of things. You know, certainly there's more I could do. I feel I'm really just one person working on this. You know, I seek advice from other editors and I'm get along with them really well. I have a really close working relationship with Nick and Michael and Laura, and I just try and like get drawing them and like, but sometimes also I have to sort of push them and be like, hey, you know, even though this thing is gross and weird and tacky and you think it's stupid, we need to do it because you fall out of relevance otherwise, you know? So it's, and of course it's sort of the ultimate irony when Nick Pinkerton is writing something about, oh, this page view driven culture, and it's like our most popular story of the month. It's sort of, you know, I talked with Walter Bernstein and Edmundo Desnos last week.
That was a fantastic episode. Yeah, I really enjoyed that.
It was kind of nerve wracking because it came together a lot faster than I thought it was going to. I thought I would have more time to prepare. But, you know, when they were talking about like, oh, capitalism, it can sort of absorb these critiques and still continue. I mean, that's sort of true of a lot of like the online media economy, I think too, where it's like, there's no one really figuring out an alternative. So we just sort of have to exist as dignified as we possibly can within it.
Now, yeah. And hope that obviously that that people will be drawn to your take on whatever the conversation is, because it'll be a smart, informed, you know, hopefully reasoned take on it. Have you kind of noticed different tones emerging, you know, when, because obviously you have writers who are on the who kind of write for the magazine and then stuff on the website and then on the podcast. Have you found that they're yourself and other writers have different kind of voices when they talk about film and when they write about film in the different platforms and the different ways that you've got?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was sort of terrified when I first started doing the podcast, like the prospect of having to sit down and verbalize things, because it's definitely a skill. It's like doesn't necessarily come naturally to a lot of people, and there are people that I've asked, like very excellent writers that I've asked to participate, and they're like, no, I'm a writer, my medium is writing, like I chose that for a reason, I'm not going to I forget how they said it, but like sort of like, you know, like under like sort of like pillage my thoughts for something that would be written just to say, you know, like the sort of that sort of thing. So yeah, I mean, I feel like I've gotten better at it, but definitely I feel way more comfortable with writing. Like, cause you know, when you're in front of like a blank document, you're sort of God in a way that you're God, not God on a film set. Like you can move anything, you can move any word where you want it. You can get it as perfect as you want it, as opposed to like a lot of other mediums where it's like, you know.
Yeah. That's like a holdover, isn't it? From the idea of the written word as the kind of the ultimate form of transmitting thought, I suppose. So and I know you can tell, I think, some of the podcasts that really struggle with wanting to write everything first so that they're presenting it orally, which I think is often, you know, just a kind of a recipe for disaster, I think. And so I wanted to sort of move on to talk about cinema, really, and where it stands. It's weird because obviously, you know, there's so much talk about the poor state of cinema, which, you know, Dario and I certainly don't subscribe to, but almost in the week that we've had, it feels like we should talk about something quite positive. But I just wondered, where do you think kind of American cinema is right now? I don't mean of sort of, you know, as a whole, but, you know, particularly that kind of American artistry and film, you know, do you think it's in a good state? You know, do you think it's in an interesting state? You know,
well, here's the thing. Because the Film Society, which is the publisher of Film Comment, which, you know, it runs art house, movie theater, repertory theater, and then also does new releases as well. I think you always get kind of into cagey territory when you're talking about, you know, new national cinema, because any given year, it's completely beholden to, you know, whatever funding bodies exist. It's beholden to whatever what people are thinking, what people are feeling. And like, you know, some year, like New Spanish Cinema, like they would have, like Film Society used to have a bunch of these different series, like New Spanish Cinema, New Romanian Cinema, New Grecian Cinema, whatever. And some, a lot of times those, like the movies that they brought were bad. Like, I don't have a problem saying it. They were just bad. And it's like, well, of course they're not going to be great if all of you're limiting yourself to only movies made within the past year within this country. And so to approach American cinema with that sort of disclaimer, I mean, I think that this was a particularly strong year for film overall after last year, which was pretty lame, you know? So we're definitely at a point, we were at a funny point where, you know, everyone's going on and on about prestige TV and, you know, like vinyl. Like, if you can't make a good, you can't make a good TV show about the most interesting period of rock and roll history, like, how can you say that this is, that we're living in this golden age? Like, that's bullshit. Like, that's stupid. So I have faith, you know, even though movies have sort of fallen to maybe the, they've been marginalized or diminished in a certain way, I definitely have faith that interesting people are going to find them. Interesting people find the medium, they find interesting things to say. There's definitely like a glut of too many films right now. I mean, everyone talks about this, you know, just like how much stuff just goes straight to VOD, you know, so quickly. And it's like, you can't keep on top of it, but also why would you bother to keep on top of it if it's not, it's not very good? You know, I think that it would be great if there were, you know, like right now it's really just like Sundance Institute and it's really just Sundance that sort of provides that, you know, extra layer of support for up and coming independent filmmakers. But with the Sundance Institute, it's very standardized. And I think it would be great if there were more bodies that existed like that, that sort of could help, you know, connect young people, you know, somebody younger with people who have more experience, serve as a sounding board, but not to the detriment and not turn into a Sundance movie. So, and I think that existed definitely in the 90s in on the coast. And you see that, like the weird, unbelievable sort of movies that, you know, independent film, what independent film used to be like. And now it's sort of like the same thing over and over again, with the same structure, et cetera. So I think that, you know, now that like Vimeo is sort of investing, maybe that could provide a outlet, or, you know, these different bodies are sort of branching out into these new forms of supporting artists. And I think that's good. And so that gives me hope.
It's weird, isn't it? Because the Sundance thing, I mean, it's hard to see where people would come in and do that with TV being so dominant in the conversation. So it's almost requires a grassroots approach, which obviously, you know, something like Vimeo is, they've generally always supported truly independent filmmakers, you know, through their promotion. So you hope that when they take the step up and start investing and really kind of promoting, that they'll stay true to that. And I think that'd be really interesting in terms of the type of films that could come through.
Just a quick break here to remind you that you can contact the Cinematologist podcast via various means. We are on Twitter at Cinematologists, via email at cinematologists@gmail.com, and on Facebook /Cinematologists. We are also extremely grateful when audience members share the podcast via their own networks, and also particularly if you have time, it would be great if you could drop us an iTunes review. I know it seems kind of shallow and coercive asking for 4 and 5 star reviews, but let's face it, that's what the digital world is all about. If you could drop over to the iTunes review page and say something positive about us, we really would appreciate it. And now let's get back to Neil and Violet.
So there's no crisis in cinema, which is good. How important do you think it is for film comment to retain primarily its film focus in an age where there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of talk about TV, there's a lot of writing about TV and a lot of writing about the web and kind of the idea of content as this nebulous thing. You know, how important is it that film comment kind of acknowledges that stuff but retains its position as a kind of a film magazine and podcast?
Well, I mean, you can get that shit anywhere. That's always my response. It's just like, you can get, there are so many different places you can get that. They expand every day. But, you know, Film Comment, it's the title, Film Comment. Like, yeah, it's, you yeah. should just, it's, it, it feels, you know, there have been times definitely where it's like, well, why, it is silly that we can't write about this because it's not film, it's not enough related to film. But then it's more ultimately, you know, like in the past, I've felt that way, you know, about, you know, pitching things and being like, oh, why can't we write about this? But now in retrospect, it's like, well, those things go away. Those things are sort of, you know, it ultimately doesn't matter. Like the focus of the magazine, it is for specialists. It is for people specifically interested in film. So just stick with that. Don't mess with what works.
I mean, it's so nice to hear you kind of talking so kind of frankly about it, because obviously there's a lot of fear about not being engaged with, you know, with the media as widely as possible. And that's one of the things I love about the podcast is how frank you are about films and about filmmakers particularly. And it's really, I mean, it's quite amazing to hear contributors kind of really criticizing filmmakers who are regarded at the kind of the top of the profession, you know, very kind of cinematic, visually kind of very stylized filmmakers. And there's a lot of kind of really, I mean, you know, well-informed, but kind of very harsh kind of criticism. And that's always been something that struck me is, you know, where do you think that confidence comes from in terms of just being able to say that, you know, Iñárritu is a hack kind of thing? Because which he is, I think, as well. But yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that one, that episode, the sort of the best of the worst, worst of the best, that's probably one of our most controversial episodes, I think. That episode made a lot of people angry, and they really let us know.
Well, that's what I was going to ask about the backlash, you know, because it's one thing to put it behind a paywall or in a subscription or in a paid magazine, but just to put it on the internet, it seems like that's going to have a different, you know, so there was a kind of backlash to that.
Oh, no, definitely. Like, I mean, there was somebody who wrote a very detailed comment where they're like, look, podcasting isn't your medium. Give it up. This sucks. Like, everyone on here is so hateful and terrible. And it's like, well, you know, that's within the, I mean, I don't know. I think if you read back in the magazine, if you're familiar with the history of the magazine, you know, somebody like Elliot Stein was saying that, you know, Fitzcarraldo is this pompous piece of garbage. You know, he's calling, like, a lot of these, I mean, really, some of the things that, I mean, you know, Elliot Stein wrote, responding to things that were at the New York Film Festival, it's interesting to hear somebody dissent. And I think that's sort of the value of, you know, going in so frankly, and not pretending that, I mean, what? It's like, they're not good, like, these people, like, we're gonna run into somebody at a party and they're gonna be mad at us. Like, I mean, it's silly, you know. It's not. There's so much, I think, a lot of like recycled PR with when it comes to reporting. You know, like film reporting now is not really what it's nothing what it used to be. It's really just taking something a publicist sent you and, you know, moving a few words around and pretending like it's objective, and that's stupid. You know, it's so, I think, being very honest about these things, and sort of accepting the fact that you are going to make people mad, offend people, that's fine. You know, it's just ultimately, like, it's like, I mean, I, you know, people think of criticism as like this low bottom feeding thing, and ultimately it's not. It is a form, it is sort of an art form, you know, where you're putting something, you're making yourself vulnerable in a certain respect, which is what the act of creation always is. It's making yourself vulnerable. So embrace it. It's fine.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Yeah, because, you know, I was listening to the podcast, and, you know, all the filmmakers and the films that were coming up at the start, I was like, absolutely. And then I didn't get offended, but then I was like, people sort of talking about Paul Thomas Anderson, who I absolutely adore, and I'm like, oh my god, how, you know. So yeah, I mean, I think that kind of that critical approach is key, because there's the great Toronto episode where, you know, you've got two people sitting side by side, I assume, in the room, and talking about American Honey. And one is really positive about it, and the other one is really negative about it. But both those positions are allowed to exist side by side. You know, there might have been a row afterwards, but there was a kind of respect for critical opinion and the chance to to argue your side and critique it, which I think is so rare. So of course people can say, "Oh, you shouldn't do this," because it doesn't really fit with what we kind of expect from digital and internet content at the moment.
Oh no, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, there are a lot of times where somebody, like in life, will ask me like, "Oh, what did you think of this movie?" And or they'll tell me their opinion of this movie, and it'll be completely opposed to what I feel, and or I'll say that I hated this movie that they love, and they get a little afraid, and I'm like, no, it's fine. It's like everyone has a reason. Like, I don't have a problem with disagreeing with somebody as long as they have valid reasons. Like, yeah. If this thing that like I feel is emotionally manipulative, if you enjoyed that, that's fine. Like, if you have a valid reason, like I'll tell you one of the. This happened the day of the election too, which is just like really shows what a shitty day it was. Like this someone was talking about Boyhood and they said, "Oh, I hated Boyhood. I just didn't see enough of my own childhood in there." And this is a straight white guy who's in his like 30s, you know, he grew up in Connecticut, and it's just like, it's called Boyhood. It's not like your boyhood. Like that's the stupidest fucking thing I've heard. Like I can't. So that's an opinion that I can't respect. But if somebody said, "Oh, I didn't like Boyhood because X, Y, and Z," you know, I thought Linklater did this, you know, and Boyhood is a film that I really love, even though it's not like my childhood. It's fine. You know, it's like, just come up. Like because again, it's like that, it's that difference between criticism and reviewing where it's like, you're coming up with an argument and you're making these, you're unfolding it in different ways. And it's like, if you're doing it in a beautiful, interesting way that holds water, then great. If it's just like, no, well, that's worthless. That's, you can, you know, it's like a child telling a child to go to bed. No, like that's stupid. It's very stupid.
Have you, I mean, you know, it's kind of, it's probably a question you might not want to answer in terms of, but obviously have you found that commitment to kind of approaching criticism in that way, you know, with the podcast and on the website has built a following, you know, have you seen a kind of, is it a significant number of people, or is it a very kind of loyal and rabid community that's built up around those kind of arms of the film comment brand?
I mean, I was surprised that it found an audience. Just in terms of, it's surprised. I mean, I'm always surprised to hear somebody be like, "Oh, I've read your," like I meet them and like, "Oh, I've read your writing." It's like, I'm surprised because there's just so much stuff out there. I'm surprised that anyone can find anything. I'm always like really endeared by that. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely like the numbers are significant. It's not, you know, just like a group of, there's definitely like a small group of like crazy devotee cultists, and I think that's excellent. I love that there are like people who are, you know, cult, like it's just so exciting to me as someone who's been like a fan of like weird cult TV shows growing up that I could, you know, it's not nearly the same thing, but the idea that someone could really, the fact that it is almost like exclusionary in a certain respect where you do need a certain level of film knowledge, you sort of have to track what happens episode to episode. Like you have, I mean, Film Comment has always sort of been like the economist for film. I mean, even though whatever you can say about the economist's larger politics, you do have to really follow it. You have to read a couple of issues before you can really follow it. And so this is sort of the same thing. And I'm fine with that because there's plenty of entry level, surface level PR stuff out there. And so reward the devoted.
Has the podcast changed since you started doing it in 2013 in terms of how you approach it, or what kind of episodes you want to focus on more because you know they work, and you know, has there been a kind of tonal shift at all, do you think?
Well, originally we wanted the podcast to be sort of like focused on the home movie section and be the lead, you know, be an expanded version of the lead DVD review. So people could sort of like interact with it more. And again, I think just because it was back in 2013, people really just weren't into it. Like I would have a really hard time getting guests. People were very like, "Oh, I don't know enough about the subject. Oh, I don't feel comfortable talking about this. I'm super," and it just kept not happening for again and again and again. And then at the beginning of this year, I sat down with Nick Rippold, and you know, there was a big staffing change. There was an editorial change, and so we were like, "Look, let's figure out, let's be the best we can be. Let's figure out what we're going to do for this next year. And, you know, let's make this podcast happen. And so, you know, I talk every, you know, I'll talk with Nick about who to have on, you know, potential ideas for topics. And I talk with Michael about it too, and sort of like brainstorm. And the act that, you know, the fact that it's sort of, it's, you know, us talking and not necessarily following what we think would be popular, I think helps it too, because it's, we're not, we have an idea of what people like and what people respond to. And we definitely have ideas of like doing something maybe more produced, structured, that would allow for a bigger audience, let's say, you know, maybe something not like, I mean, obviously the dominant mode of public radio in the U.S. is This American Life. Like every show follows that format because it's a winning format. Like you can't lose if you do that, what they do. And so we would, at some point in the future, we would maybe want to do something that is more like that, where it's like a little bit more, a little less like it's just you listening in on these group, this group of people have this possibly very contentious discussion. So, but yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know, there's still, I feel like there's a lot of different ways we can take it, and if possible, take it all those directions, because why not?
You seem very committed to kind of approaching it in the film comment way. But sometimes it feels like there might be a danger of that, because I think what's something that Dario and I have noticed is that out of all the podcasts we listen to, yours is the probably the best in terms of the diversity question, in terms of the, you know, in terms of race and gender, in terms of background of the contributors. But it's never flagged up. You know, it's not like, you know, here's the black critic, here's the female critic. But by just kind of having a really brilliantly diverse sort of group of people to call from, it's so positive, because these are really intelligent, educated, cine-literate people bringing their own context to the work. But what I guess is that there is a danger, in, because of the age that we live in, that positive work that is being done, which is how everything should be approached, which is, you know, naturally kind of taking people on their own intellect and ability and whether they're nice people, is kind of lost, because you're not shouting about the good things that you're doing. And
I mean, there's always, I feel like every 6 months to a year, there's an article that talks about, why are there no female film critics? Why is that? You know, and they're kind of, and they look at Rotten Tomatoes, which is the worst thing you could look at. Like, why, like this, regard, you know, I'll leave that alone for a second, but, and, you know, there's this cry for more diverse voices, more women, and, you know, a woman who had a bad experience being edited by a guy comes out of the woodwork and she says this, that, and the other, and sometimes that's just, you know, sometimes it is sexism and sometimes it's just part of being edited. And it's hard, you know, obviously the world of social media is not the real world. But I do, I definitely understand what you're saying. And I think, you know, I live in New York. There are people from all over the world here of all sorts of gender identities, of races, et cetera. And so it's not something that it's, I mean, there's definitely times where it's like, oh, you know, we should have, I feel like more it comes down to, like you're saying, like people's knowledge and people's personalities. Yeah. And, but definitely there are some times where it's like, you know, come on, like we gotta shake it up. We gotta have more, we gotta have a woman on, like, come on, stupid. But it is important to me. I'm not going to pretend like it isn't, but I also think it's important not to wave it around. I think that racism and sexism, those are things that we just saw. They didn't go away over the past 8 years.
I'm not going to steal your the way you end your podcast and ask for a good film that you've seen recently. But I'm just wondered, you know, because obviously it's, I live in the middle of nowhere. So what, you know, I won't be seeing Patterson for a while. I won't be seeing Tony Erdmann, if at all, at the cinema. But, you know, what are you excited about seeing? You know, what's kind of out there that you can't wait to see that's coming down the line?
Good question. God, I don't even know. I mean, it'd probably be just something old, you know, like there's lots of great rep stuff going on. So I'd really try to, I don't know. I feel like I've seen, I didn't see Lost City of Z. That's one thing I did not see. So I'm actually excited to see that. I'll see.
Right.
That.
Me too. Yeah, me too. Cool. So you get to the cinema quite a lot then?
No, actually.
No?
No, it's pathetic. I work, our offices are above like 4 movie theaters and I don't really see that much stuff there, you know, because it's like the end of the day, you want to go home, or like the showtime is weird, so I don't always see stuff there, but I do see, I try to, you know, on the weekends or whatever.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me.
Yeah,
it's been fun. Really, really appreciate it. Yeah, keep up the good work.
Thanks.
And yeah, hopefully see you soon.
Yeah, thank you.
So that was me talking to Violet Luca from Film Comment, and as Dario mentioned earlier, there is a kind of full-length version, which is a bit more rambling, available on the website. But Dario, so what did you make of that conversation?
There were so many sort of little elements I thought that were interesting, particularly, I mean, to start with, just the relationship between the magazine and the podcast was an interesting one, because they started up as being a kind of DVD review, and that didn't work. And then moved on to sort of trying to sort of mirror some of the themes that were coming up in the magazine. And it's just really fascinating to me how the relationship between the written word and podcasting in terms of criticism as an overarching phenomenon. That relationship is very interesting. And I think it's one of the things that we've covered a lot, obviously, in the last podcast, the experimental podcast we've just done. And to hear specific writers saying that they just write, they don't want to talk about the thing that they've written. There's this sort of sense of the all-encompassing, you picked up on this, the all-encompassing finality of the written word on the page, and her having to learn, you know, how to sort of talk on a podcast and how to do interviews and that kind of stuff. That's fascinating to me because it's something that we're always sort of reiterating and working on ourselves. It was really interesting, I thought, wasn't it, when she talked about the hostility to the episode that is about the best of the worst of the best directors. And that is just such a great listen. And it reminds me of the differences in terms of form and content within different film podcasts that you would say are quite, in a general sense, see as quite similar. Because I think that you would put probably us and Film Comment alongside each other in a sort of subgenre of academic film podcasts, maybe. But you know, I don't think that would be particularly our style, would it, to have an episode where we just sort of say, you know, I'm going to slag this off in that particular way. And I think that was very much a sort of shows the difference between academia and journalism. Although she did say, you know, that and I agree with this because I feel the same way about myself, that it's trying to get beyond that idea of good and bad. But they really were indulging in that episode, that sense of this is good and this is absolutely terrible.
Well, I think it's, yeah, there's so many things that struck me about that episode. And it was amazing to hear that they had that kind of backlash, because listening to it, you think word must get out about what these critics who write for Sight and Sound, you know, Little White Lies, Film Comment, you know, that what they're saying about these filmmakers. And obviously it did. And it was, you know, they're talking kind of freely about filmmakers and films that they don't like, because, and this is something else that Violet kind of mentioned, you know, that they consider themselves critics. So the job of reviewing them is simply a job. So they're not invested in those filmmakers. Where they see that their work is kind of meaningful to them is in the stuff that they like and the stuff they celebrate. They're not interested in being in that space where they have to fawn over people they don't like. And I think there was a kind of reverie in it, but then I think most of the time I would say that they're just working. So they're talking about these ideas on paper or on a podcast, or they're working in their own field and their own area. So there was it felt like a chance to kind of get together and vent and share that kind of experience. And that was really interesting. I think the thing about that we do, because I was thinking about this as well, is that we're always trying to find the good and the a way through a piece of work which kind of assumes something positive about it. I think because obviously we're investing a lot of time in a film, we're not really hate watchers. And I think one of the reasons we started the podcast was to not do that, to engage with films that we liked or films that we found interesting rather than that.
And we don't actually have to engage with any particular film if we don't want to. Like, I mean, we won't show you know, in a Ritu film, most likely. I mean, we definitely won't show anything.
They're all about 8 hours. So.
Yeah, exactly. They're too long anyway. But do you know what I mean? Yeah. We just won't show the film. And we probably won't even... we have sort of slipped now and again into talking about blockbuster culture and stuff like that. But we tend to just leave that completely alone. But they... I think, obviously, that's the difference between the magazine. They've got a magazine as their basis, and then the podcast is out of that. That they have to engage with what is being talked about. And again, that was another thing that came out of the discussion, that there has to be an engagement with what is current and what is going on. You can't just sort of leave that behind when you've got that magazine, which is a sort of, I suppose, kind of sees itself, or the people who work there see that as the gatekeepers of film criticism or film cinephilia, I would say, in America. Yeah.
And we are privileged because we're not faced with that. You know, like you say, because we have day jobs and other things which kind of occupy our time and our minds, this is something which we can, yeah, we curate and we kind of do what we want with, really. So, yeah, we wouldn't necessarily pick a film that we're just going to slag off. There's nothing interesting in that. You know, why would we want to do that? So yeah, it was really kind of startling to hear Violet sort of kind of talk about it, and it was just, it was really positive just to, you know, just to see that they weren't kind of rattled by it, that they felt that their approach was the right one for them, as people and as a magazine, and that they were happy to kind of keep ploughing their own field, as it were. And what's great is that episode kind of stands alone, really, because since then they've kind of gone back into the kind of the areas that they can regularly talk about, which is great, because I think a lot of other people would exploit that controversy or exploit that opportunity to kind of get a little bit of notoriety, and obviously it's good that they're not interested in that. So
it relates, I think, quite a lot to this idea of what are some of the problems with internet discourse, and the thing that we try to do ourselves, but also I think that podcasting allows or kind of invites, is that much more deliberative conversational debate where disagreement can happen, but then you can agree to disagree and move on, or you can, you know, I mean, obviously disagreements can be vigorous, and there may be a sense in which resolution is not found, but that's not really the aim, I suppose. And I think maybe that episode was very much a sort of one-off version of, you know, we're really going to sort of vent about these certain directors and films. But I think that it would be, I can't see Film Comment being the kind of podcast that would sort of fall into that trap of just taking that sort of negative hack job idea and running with it time and time again, because it's an easy option, isn't it, in terms of creating a podcast or in criticism, doing the hack job. It's an easy out often, and it's much more difficult to engage with why perhaps you didn't get on with something particular.
Yeah, and I think even that episode, it was balanced. It wasn't just these are films we like by filmmakers we hate. It was films we hate by filmmakers we love. You know, they were trying to find their way through the often problematic terrain of being a fan, and a film fan, or yeah, being a critic.
So in our discussions, obviously, and then listening to these podcasts, which are essentially, a lot of them are just sort of dropping in on people's conversations and debates about film, I often wonder if it's possible to change somebody's mind. You know, within that course of argument, that course of debate, and it doesn't matter how rationally and articulately you put your point across, you know, how often does it get to the point where somebody goes, do you know what? You're probably right there, and I'm probably wrong.
Well, you didn't change your mind about Pacific Rim, so...
How did I know that was coming up?
Well, because I think it's a great example, you know, okay.
But you didn't either.
No.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah.
No, because I think it's, you know, for those of you who might be late, newer to the podcast, there is an old episode where Dario and I debate vigorously Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim, Dario from a kind of negative starting point and me from a positive starting point. And we pretty much stay in those starting points. But I think that was always going to be a film that we were never going to persuade each other on, you know, because I think that you're absolutely right in the things you find wrong with it. And I'm fully aware of its flaws, you know, so, but it's still interesting to kind of argue. And it is a film I genuinely, genuinely love. I think that I'm not sure people ever really do change their mind. And I think that is not always a good thing. You know, I think it's, you know, watching Lost in Translation again, it's a long time since I've seen it, and I was kind of going in wondering what I would make of it. And despite seeing all the things wrong with it and all the things that have way that my ability to watch a film or the way, you know, the things I see when I watch a film have shifted considerably in the last sort of 10 or so years, I still can't disavow it. You know, I can't shake that kind of sense of satisfaction I got when I first watched it. Interesting that, you know, in the podcast we've just done, we referenced a recent chat on the Cinephiliacs with Scott Bucatman, talking about this kind of almost modern, you know, disease of finding the meaning in everything. Going back to what you were saying earlier about, you know, this need for female filmmakers to be feminist filmmakers, you know, there's the simple joys of watching something and let it wash over you and engaging with it on a kind of almost primal level are so far down the list of kind of objectives now that it's a shame. And I think that I do find it difficult to go back to work that I loved and kind of completely distance myself from it. But I'd like to think that there are a number of films and filmmakers that I'm still open to changing my mind about. And that's why I kind of try and read so much and listen so much, because I'm always thinking, well, what's the other side of this, you know?
Yeah, I think I've changed my mind on quite a lot of things, but I don't think I've ever changed my mind. I can't think of a film or a, you know, collection of films or a filmmaker that I've changed my mind because of somebody else's argument about it. I've changed my mind because I've gone back and I've changed, or I've gotten older, or I've recognized something in a film that I've liked or not liked, or whatever it might be. But I mean, maybe that might have been instigated by somebody saying, go and see this. I mean, like, it's really interesting to me because I can't wait for you to see the Assayas films, because I don't know if you've watched Clouds of Sils Maria yet.
No, I was supposed to see Personal Shopper at the Cornwall Film Festival last week, but right, they cancelled it. So, okay. And I was going to watch the two back to back. So,
you see, I think Clouds of Sils Maria is a modern classic, and I thought Personal Shopper was terrible, and I really sort of want to watch them both again. And I had the same experience with American Honey as well. It was like a lot of it was really getting on my nerves. But yet, you know, so many people had said they had this kind of almost transcendent experience watching it. And I want to kind of understand that. So I suppose it comes with more of an experienced mind, let's say, where you can be open to the idea that you're bringing yourself to the text.
I think, I think you should be able to watch a film and see how it could be transcendent for others, because it's engaging. You can appreciate it aesthetically and stylistically and thematically, but emotionally it's not engaging those parts of you that cause that transcendence. I think that's absolutely valid. And I think, the problem is we live in a culture where everything has to be 100% good, 100% bad. You know,
But nothing is, of course.
You know, we can't say, well, nothing is, and nothing ever was, and never will be. And this idea that you can appreciate something, you can talk about something almost from a distance of saying, yeah, I accept, I know what it's doing, but it doesn't engage me. It's like people can't seem to get their head around that, which is just sad, because that's where 95% of the things you see sit. You know, most of the films I watch, I have problems with, or, you know, but there are... If it's good, and it's what I was sort of saying earlier about, you know, that kind of trying to find the positive in, you know, and assuming that the filmmaker has an objective in mind that they're trying to go for, and even if I don't necessarily go along with it.
Let's move on to the post-screening Q&A with myself and Melody Bridges and the audience at the Kino after Lost in Translation.
Hi. Well, I don't know. Do you want to start? What did you think about watching it again on the big screen?
I think this is a fantastic film in lots of ways. It's beautifully filmed. The cinematography is fantastic. The two central performances are strong, and there are some really lovely, strong scenes in there as well. There are moments when I think, gosh, this is what I really like about cinema. And then there are some moments as well where I just think, no, why did you make that choice? And so, just as I said, generally, I think that it's a Marmite film, that some people love it and some people hate it. I personally swing throughout the film with how much I love it and hate it. So it's quite a kind of complex film for me.
I was struck this time by how much actually it revolves around Bill Murray's performance, actually. You know, he's so central to this film working. You know, in his comedy, in his gestures, in how he's reacting to Scarlett Johansson, particularly as well how he's reacting to his wife on the phone. And there was that so many little subtle moments where, like, when he tells her, I've got a day off tomorrow, and she's like, oh, you've got a day off tomorrow. It's just sort of that little kind of passive aggression was there. And it's just like, yeah, it kind of sums up. And again, I think it is true that the Lost in Translation is the translation between their partners. Because obviously there's the photographer, Giovanni Ribisi, who is apparently modelled on Spike Jonze, Sofia Coppola's first partner. So, yeah, some really interesting sort of relationships going on there. And Anna Faris, apparently, so I was reading, is modelled on Cameron Diaz. So I don't know how much that is true or not. So obviously there's a lot of autobiographical stuff going on. I know what you're talking about with the choices and stuff. I mean, did it sort of strike you? I mean, there were certain moments where what you mentioned about the way that Japanese culture is depicted. And it's funny because some parts I think are quite referential and sort of portraying that really beautifully. And then just the sort of cheap jokes with the L's and the R's is a little bit, you know, struck me as really kind of clunky at times.
Yeah, I think there are some really cheap laughs and some really tasteless stuff. You know, I don't feel real comfortable about that scene. I mean, I know we're not supposed to feel comfortable about it anyway, but I still don't feel comfortable about the scene where the prostitute is sent to his bedroom and how that's all handled and played for laughs. It's just still, it feels very uncomfortable. And obviously there's a kind of joke against her, really, I feel.
Yeah.
And I think just some of it is a little clunky, and it's supposed to be very alienating. They're never really with Japanese people. We never fully see Japanese people talking, talking amongst themselves, talking openly. We hardly have any women speaking, women speaking. And so I feel like it's very much an alien culture.
But isn't that the point, though? But isn't that... I mean, again, I've read defences of that, which have highlighted the things that you're talking about. But also, like, say, for example, when they have the laugh of him advertising the whiskey and the director's sort of saying loads and then she only translates a very small portion. But actually, there is, if you look online, there's a translation with subtitles of what he's saying. And it's actually because she sums it up perfectly, exactly what he's trying to get across. And as well with the talk show, I was reading today that is absolutely accurate, you know, that how sort of cheesy those talk shows look. So there's a sort of defense on the one hand that says a lot of this is quite accurate. And then on the other hand, well, yeah, they are. Both of them are supposed to be completely alienated in that way. But you know what I mean? I think you can take it either way in that sense, I suppose.
Yes. It feels a little disappointing though, because there would be ways to get in. Hear early on that Scarlett Johansson is, to be fair, she's only there for 1 week. And if you can't find stuff to do in Japan in 1 week, you're not trying hard
enough.
So to have so much boredom and so much ennui in 1 week, I think really does down her character. And just generally, I think that she could have a lot more to say about who she is and what she wants in life. And otherwise, we're just kind of like planting our own stuff on her. And I don't feel very comfortable with that. But also, I just think that the whole thing we have learned that she and her husband have good friends in Japan. That's why she went.
Yeah.
So we get to meet this character of Charlie Brown for about 2 seconds. It's like, oh yeah, Charlie Brown, that's my nickname or whatever. Who is he? I want to know who he is. Why is he a good friend? Have they got to know each other in America? There are definitely ways that could be explored more.
And it's funny as well how the Giovanni Ribisi character, the photographer, just disappears completely in the second half of the movie. It just gone, you know, from view. Yes. Totally.
Yeah, he's gone. He's seen as he's very superficially read as well, isn't he? As is that kind of female movie star too.
Sure.
You know, we're obviously invited to laugh at her. So yeah, there's a lot of good humor in there, definitely. And there's lots of moments you really enjoy, but there are also moments I think, it's just a bit.
But he does really well though with the just the sort of, there's almost kind of like a physical comedy going on as well as the bit where he's on the sort of cyclocross trainer. And just his movements are just so, you know, sort of subtle in terms of pointing out little bits of his own relationship to what's going on around him and how he's feeling in reaction to that, which is really, you know, really smart. He's obviously.
I think they're definitely, you've got two stars and they're doing really, really well and they're working really, really hard. But as you pointed out earlier, I feel a little uncomfortable about that massive age gap between them and that it is supposed to be some kind of Hollywood romance-ish. Whereas I used to feel like it was more, maybe I had a different reading of it when I first saw it maybe 10 years ago. I felt it was more of a kind of platonic relationship. That's why I said that there's a scene that disappoints me. And for me, the scene that disappoints me is the kiss at the end.
Right.
Because I thought that it was much more about a kind of meeting of minds in a way.
Right.
And then I feel like it just goes to a cliche territory for personally.
Right.
We have a kiss.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because there's the reaction of Scarlett Johansson when she discovers that he spent the night with the lounge singer. And yeah, that's when it kind of moves over and you're not sure, because she's kind of jealous, but she isn't really, and she knows that she shouldn't be, and she's kind of behaving like a spoilt brat, and then he gives her that comment, which is sort of like, you know, you're talking rubbish, you're a child, you don't know what you're on about.
Yes, so I mean, it's again, we've got a kind of disposable female character. Women apparently come in, throw sex at him, and then they go away. So what a lucky man. I mean, I think they're quite... they're both quite unsympathetic, really.
Yeah, they are. That's what I noticed that as well. Yeah.
When he says earlier on, you know, I could be, I'm being paid $2 million to be here, but I could be doing a play.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I feel so
hard,
bad
isn't
for
it?
You.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
so sorry, Bill Murray. Life is so tough.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's super fun to see him kind of slightly mocking the photography industry and the film industry. And so in that way, so I suppose Sofia Coppola is having fun at the Hollywood machine that has chewed him up with his movies in the 70s, 80s, spat him out, and now he's a kind of minor star somewhere else.
So. But who she is as well, I think it definitely comes through that, isn't it? Because it's Sofia Coppola, obviously, and she has she's not just somebody who's, you know, the accusations of nepotism and all that are well known. And she's obviously grown up around that sort of LA Hollywood movie making lifestyle. So it's coming from a particular place. So yeah, maybe those are offshoots of what her cultural position is.
Yeah, although I think one always has to be careful, because it's an accusation that's often thrown at female writers as well as female directors, that their material is autobiographical. And that's much more often thrown at women than it is at men.
Right.
And there's that kind of concept that they can't necessarily have an imagination outside of their own lives, where of course women do, just as men do. Just as a man could write a brilliant female character and a woman could write a brilliant male character. So one has to be careful of kind of... easy assumptions.
Okay. Does anybody want to... Holly? Thanks very much for being the first.
It will probably be a bit of a circuitous two-parter question, which is, earlier on you alluded to the fact that Sofia Coppola is very much seen as like a millennial filmmaker. And obviously I'm kind of very much part of that age group, that cohort. And I think two things. For me, watching this again, I haven't watched it for 10 years. It was like my favourite film in my late teens when I was kind of... you know, going off to do film at uni and stuff, and was like, so you say it's beautifully shot. And I think there's an element of it being about that period in your life, and that we perhaps don't have quite so many films as you have like teen kind of coming of age. But I think there's something very interesting about that period in your 20s where you finish college, university, and then you're kind of trying to figure it out. So for me, watching it again, it feels very much a film about that particular time in your life. And to me now, I read much very different things into it than I did when I watched it originally. So is that. The other thing, which is the second part, is do you not feel that sort of preoccupation with what I would call kind of white middle class or even very privileged white angst is not just characteristic of a lot of Sofia Coppola's films, but a lot of those kind of Indiewood films as well, the kind of Wes Anderson, you know, things like Ice Storm, you know, all those kinds of movies of that period that were quite sort of, you know, often distributed through the major distributors, but sort of indie films. Do you think that's quite a common theme as well, kind of that Yes, white problems of rich white people, basically.
I mean, people say like hashtag first world problems. Now, of course, actually Japan is first world, but it does feel like a very privileged world. And it feels very like, oh no, in your beautiful hotel, you can't get to sleep. Oh, how terrible. It is difficult to sympathize with these people who seem to have so much time and seem to be so lucky in so many ways. That's why I think it would be so much more interesting to have a backstory to Scarlett. Why are you so lost? What are you doing? I mean, we just learned that she's a philosophy major. That's it. You know, I want to know so much more than we're given. But you're absolutely right. I feel that it's a kind of mirror to self of the millennials.
And yeah, I think you're right in terms of the sort of collection of movies that are, you know, offshoot of or a product of IndieWood, as it was called, this sort of self-obsessed navel-gazing stories, which sometimes can get kind of irritating. I mean, I do think I would go back to this film is really lives and dies by Bill Murray in that way. If somebody was managing to be sort of unsympathetic, because, you know, like when anybody who comes up and says hello, I'm pleased to meet you, he just like blanks them completely, except for Scarlett Johansson, of course. So yeah, I think that there's a sense in which it could have with a different actor, it could have been a much more difficult film to really enjoy. But you do enjoy it, because I think you're right. You do sort of see the problems with it, but you can't help but enjoy it because of him.
He's hugely enjoyable. He's hugely entertaining to watch, and that's what people remember about it, and that's why they enjoy the humour of it. But then you can also see that people are corpsing on the screen, and they've kept that in, which is, I think, an interesting directorial choice. You know, there's that scene whereby they're in the hospital, and he's kind of trying to strike up a conversation with the chap next to him in the hat.
Yeah.
There's two women at the back who cannot keep a straight face. They know they're supposed to be extras. I'm an extra. I'm in character. Yeah. And that similarly also happens in the Suntory Ice scene. I think that you can see clearly people behind the camera, the camera, obviously not the actual camera, but the camera on set of the director, where people are absolutely corpsing. And they've kept that in partly because I think they want people to be prompted by that and lifted by that, so that then the moments where it's kind of longer and slower and you're thinking, oh, look, doesn't Japan look beautiful? Then you can have the contrast of the two.
To kind of coincide with those points, I don't think it's much of something like, say, Knight of Cups, like Terrence Malick's last film, which was all about the existential first world crisis that people
seem
to
have. It's not quite
as
bad as that, now you're right.
Ain't thin red line. Anywho, so I don't feel it's like that. I feel like it's kind of become a film about purpose. Sounds odd, but even just being trapped in the void of purpose. So, like Scarlett's character, she has almost like no purpose at the moment. She's stuck behind her husband in a way, seeming to float around, whereas Bill is stuck in his purpose. He's got all this purpose. He's got millions. He's got a wife, yet he's trapped inside of that. And I think there's a really nice almost juxtaposition. That's why they sort of meld together. One person looking for something and the other person almost looking to get out of what they have. Like, I don't think it's as much of, oh, fuck, I've got all this money. I wish I was doing the play. As much as it is, like, even no matter what you have, sometimes you get points where you start to question yourself and really start to question, like, is it worth it all? Especially when people who are meant to be, oh, you have it all, you have this perfect wife. Yeah, but she won't even listen to the fact that there probably is a problem. She even has to ask, like, is something wrong? And then does she really care? And he meets this one person who is totally lost, or thinks she's totally lost, even though she's perfectly fine, I feel, as a character. She is actually perfectly fine. But it kind of takes him to see that, to start to perk up a bit, if you know what I mean.
I think that the thing about them both being stuck is the key thing, isn't it? At different, obviously different periods of their life, and, you know, different types of people even, and how they, I mean, it's interesting, sort of some of the things that you were talking about, but the answer to that is that, you know, even people who have privileged lives feel, you know, loss and remorse and melancholy or whatever it might be, or going through relationship problems and this kind of stuff. Yeah, there may be a sense in which it is not, it looks like a little bit superficial when we're watching it on screen. But yeah, I think definitely, and, you know, linking to what Holly was saying about at that moment in her life, it's almost like there's a sense that she feels that, like, maybe that she hasn't got the right to complain, because, you know, Christ, look around, you know, she's living, she's got this great life on the outside, but then, yeah, you know, is that all there is? I don't know, but they are both stuck in that sense.
So I find it funny as, like, audiences, how we choose to kind of take things. So say you'd watch something like Mean Time or all those early social realist films, And it's okay to really engage with those characters and whatever little existential crises they might have, because they're at a lower level. Whereas if you take it higher, especially when you try and make characters interesting, and sadly, as audiences and as society, we normally look to celebrity to find something interesting. That may itself be superficial. But I find it funny how we almost sort of feel like we look down upon ourselves for taking like pride in those characters, and we can't give them unhappiness. You can't have unhappiness. You're rich. You know?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Gokong, do you want to follow up on that?
Yeah, no, the conversations made me think, actually, The Graduate, like, for me, that kind of seems like an interesting kind of companion text to this, actually, in terms of the whole opening sequence is very similar of him coming through the airport and just having this sense of, like, what do I do now? And in that, obviously, it goes in a very particular direction where he does have a relationship with a much older person and then kind of realises that that's a bad idea. But I think it's, yeah, sorry, it just kind of occurred to me that it's an interesting... And I think that The Graduate isn't judged in the same way, again, because it's a male filmmaker, male character. Yeah. It kind of seems a bit more legitimate that he's having this, you know, particularly 60s, you know...
And it's a younger guy there, an older woman. So again, that
it's kind of interesting that is seen as kind of, yeah, the comparison is interesting in terms of the gender and the time frame as well. I think millennials, again, are always kind of dismissed as whinging a lot more, whereas baby boomers, it was like, yeah, they were being right on and political and, you know, they were resisting the hegemony of bourgeois life. Whereas this is like, oh, you moaning millennials, you've got everything.
There were some lovely scenes in this, honestly. There are. I mean, you remember the scene where you've got the camera from above and you've got both of them on the bed. Mm. And she says, does it get any easier? Yeah. You know, I really like that scene very much.
That was my email signature for a number of years. Yeah, the bit where he says, you know, the more you know what you want... the less you let things upset you.
I was struck actually that how I didn't remember that there wasn't more of that. In my head, there was kind of more scenes of them actually discussing their lives, but there's only one scene of them on the bed of you know, having these sort of expository conversations about what they're actually thinking and feeling.
Does it get easier?
No. Yes. It gets easier.
Oh, yeah? Look at you.
Thanks. The more you know who you are and what you want, the less you let things upset you.
Yeah. I just don't know what I'm supposed to be. You know? I tried being a writer, but I hate what I write. And I tried taking pictures, but they're so mediocre, you know, and every girl goes through a photography phase, you know, like horses, you know, take dumb pictures of your feet.
You'll figure that out, and I'm not worried about you. Keep writing.
But I'm so mean.
Mean's okay. Yeah.
What about marriage? Does that get easier?
That's hard. We used to have a lot of fun. Lydia would come with me when I made the movies, and we would laugh about it all. Now she doesn't want to leave the kids, and she doesn't need me to be there. The kids miss me, but they're fine. It gets a whole lot more complicated when you have kids.
Yeah, it's scary.
It's the most terrifying day of your life, the day the first one is born.
Yeah. Nobody ever tells you that.
Your life, as you know it, is gone. Never to return. but they learn how to walk and they learn how to talk, and you want to be with them. And they turn out to be the most delightful people you will ever meet in your life.
Yeah, I think that's like a pivotal scene. Yeah. And I really, really like that. I really, that makes me feel that they're equals, they're chatting. Sure. It's obviously a platonic, it's a meeting of minds.
Mm.
And that's why I said for me, I'm disappointed by the kiss at the end.
Right, right. Go ahead, lady there.
I was just thinking about the point you made about her not having a backstory, and from a writing point of view, if it is autobiographical, which we seem to be thinking it is.
Not me, him.
supposedly autobiographical. I think there is a problem about writing a character that is you, putting yourself on the page. And often you refer to things rather than create them. If you're creating another character, you have to build it, or a scene, you can't just refer to it. And somehow I feel like with an autobiographical character on the page or on the screen, the writer is behind their eyes, if you know what I mean. So seeing out from them rather than seeing them. And sometimes that leaves a kind of absence, a kind of silhouette where a character could be. And I felt that through this film, that she's, partly that's the story, that she's an enigma and unknown to herself and all those things, but partly I feel like it might be related to that issue of writing yourself on the page.
I hadn't really thought about that. I certainly think that having written and directed something yourself, if you do the two roles rather than separating them and then having a discussion with somebody else, you're going to be much closer to the whole material. And maybe that helps elevate it sometimes, and maybe sometimes that means that things might get missed, perhaps.
Mm. I suppose it relates to that idea of who are you? Are you who you think you are, or are you as other people see you? Maybe, you know, and if you're writing about yourself, you are very obviously subjective, but then maybe there's a presentation of what your feelings are, your angst is, or your anxiety that actually clouds a sort of broader sense of the self. I don't know, that sounds very deep and probably incoherent.
We know a lot about him, as people have been saying. We know about his relationship and his wife and his children and his past and his, you know, we have a sense of him. And that's really drawn in because she's kind of behind the Scarlett Johansson character's eyes, behind, in her mind, looking at that character rather than having to create.
In a way, isn't that disappointing that we have that there is that amount of screen time given to her, this very, you know, beautiful actress, and, you know, and generally speaking, she doesn't wear any trousers, you know, you know, there could be so much more about the exploration of who she is and who she wants to be. And mainly we're kind of looking at her. We're looking at her as a very beautiful actress. And it would be nicer to be with her on that journey, I feel, in some ways. Okay, that's all right.
No, I mean, it's so true. I mean, it's like that opening shot as well. It's kind of like, what's that about, really? I mean, what's the sort of point of that?
You're talking about the semi.
Well, yeah, just it's pants. Just a bottom, basically, in full frame. And it's like, you know, I suppose it sort of relates to that idea that we were talking about before, about it's not just enough that it's a woman behind the camera. It's what are the representations? What are the, you know, what are the stories being told?
Yeah.
So, anyway, it's a little bit like what you were sort of talking about, that it's very complicated in terms of the relationship between those two ideas.
Definitely.
Or those two positions.
And you've probably come across the Bechdel test, yes, whereby you've got to have more than one woman who's named, and you've got to have two women, you know, talking.
This doesn't pass, probably. Because
totally
then
it doesn't pass.
Right, exactly, because she only talks to him.
She only talks to him. She never talks to another female character.
Yeah.
She doesn't even have any kind of bonding situation with the vacuous female star. And if anything, they're kind of pipped
against each other.
Yeah. And so, no, absolutely doesn't pass the Bechdel test. And yeah, we have a completely unnecessarily, in my opinion, strip club scene in the middle as well.
Yeah, yeah,
which
that
is totally random.
I do agree. It's easy to read it in that it's totally random, but I felt uncomfortable. And I think that actually that's what the director perhaps is trying to do, to make you feel uncomfortable. Like, we shouldn't really be looking at this. And it is incongruous in the scene for that very reason, to be uncomfortable. But it's still kind of gratuitous. So I suppose that depends on you know, your perspective when you're watching that kind of reaction. Abby? I'll come to you, James, in a second. I'm conscious of your train. If you have to run, then...
just discussing Scarlett Johansson's character, this is my first viewing of the film, and I wasn't really sure what to expect from it. But thinking of a female director, I'm kind of struggling with the idea that she has made Scarlett's character, in my opinion, a little bit bland. You do want to know more about her, but it's a very sort of torn situation to me, because part of me thinks it works, and I'm still trying so hard to view their relationship as platonic. Same as you've said, I'd like to think that they're both just a little bit lost and they've got that mutual, we're a bit lost in a different country, let's club together. And I think part of that works because she's got her very simple problem of, oh help, I don't really know who my husband is and if this is right, that's it. Compared to Bill Murray's going through a similar scenario of been married for however long and it's a bit weird. But the thing is, what I'm trying to say is, I'm not really sure. I've lost my point completely now. Oh, God.
It's all right, take your time. Are you talking about the kind of ways in which you're, on the one hand, sort of wanting to empathise with the character and wanting to understand what is going on but with her, but really the way that it comes across is not giving you enough to kind of latch onto in that sense? Was that sort of where you're going or something like that?
Definitely. I had a really good point. It's completely left me now.
Don't worry. We can edit that. James, just one about. Sorry, I'll come to you afterwards.
No, I was just going to say, I feel like I've kind of watched a different film because I have a completely different reading of Scarlett Johansson's character. Obviously, everyone's saying about her lack of backstory, but I find it so easy to identify with her as a character and her place in life by contrasting her backstory and therefore lack of backstory, and contrasting that with Bill Murray's backstory. And I think it comes down to the age difference and everything that Bill Murray has experienced, everything in life that Scarlett Johansson's character is worrying about. And so she's come to him at a point in life when they are both lost and is asking him, like, the question, like that scene on the bed that you mentioned, does it get any better? Is this what it's like? And it might just be me personally, even still the exact same way I feel the second time I've watched it. She's just trying to find her way. And even though they're both lost in different ways, but her place of being lost, she just has no experience, no nothing. And then having Bill Murray there, she looks to him. And I still find that even though, like I say, no backstory, really, apart from the fact, you know, she's married, she's had a philosophy degree, nothing that still makes her really identifiable to me.
You know, again, I suppose it's within film, you've got a limited amount of time. You've got to place your characters in a way that they are recognisable, you know, to a certain extent. So you have to fill that with the way that the character acts, and then some sense of where they come from and what their situation is. And I think, you know, what you're talking about in terms of how she's being set up, I think that point is really valid in terms of, on the one hand, you could say maybe she doesn't have much more of a backstory in terms of where the life experience she's had up to that point, and that's the thing that she's searching for. So maybe, like you were saying, it's like you identify with that idea of, oh, I haven't actually got that much underneath where I am right now, and it's like, how do I sort of build on that? How do I become what I want to be? Because she kind of says that. I mean, I don't know.
I just feel like she's very much defined by what she doesn't want.
Right.
So she keeps saying no to things. Like he, at the first time they meet at the bar and he offers her a drink, she says, no, I'll have a vodka. She won't have a Santori top. And, you know, her husband says he should stop smoking. No, I'll do it when I want to. So she's mainly defined by what she doesn't want, and she doesn't get on with lots of people, and he, like her husband, thinks that she's a snob. So that's the way that we see her, is someone who's negatively pushing lots of things away. What I want to know is, what does she really want?
Right.
What is she embracing in life? Sure. Where has she come from? And even by the time of 21, there'll be things that you've, like anyone in this room who has reached 21 will have made preferences. All the way along, you make preferences for, you know, this sport over that activity, over drama, over, you know, chess, or whatever it is. You've made choices up to the ages of 21, and part of those will define you. Of course, you might not be that person at 40, but you'll still have a kind of person of who you are at 21, I think.
Well, I'm going to sort of back up what James is saying. I think Scarlett Johansson, for me, has always been quite engaging, because quite simply, you get the best idea of what kind of a person that she is by the way that she's introduced when she's sitting out the window, and then when she's listening to little tape recorder. I think it's those little mannerisms that's shown in the film that basically give me the idea, okay, so this is what kind of a person Scarlett Johansson is. Awesome. And I guess the fact that Sofia Coppola wrote her so we want to know more about her, I suppose, for me, that shows that obviously Sofia Coppola has made someone who's quite engaging, you know, oh yeah, I want to know more about this person. You know, I think it shows quite good craft as a screenwriter. In terms of the relationship between Bob and Charlotte, Bill and Scarlett, it's the second time I viewed the film, and I've always seen their relationship as platonic, because I think the pairing of them, it's quite simply one of those points in your life when you meet someone, and obviously even if it's for X amount of time or you're in each other's lives for so little or so long, you know, they change each other for the better, and I suppose that's how Bill Murray reaches his goal in the end, because obviously I think he goes home and he seems to be a changed man, but you could sort of say, I mean, I'm not really sure what Scarlett got out of the whole experience. I mean, maybe Sofia Coppola intended for that, because obviously we've been saying, yeah, this film is as much about Bill Murray. But yeah, obviously it would have been interesting to see, okay, what's Scarlett Johansson going to do now after having this experience with Bill? And I guess, backing up what you were saying about the kiss, I mean, they loved each other, but they weren't in love with each other, is how I've always thought about it. And I think the fact that Bob does that, it was, for me, it was just a nice display of affection, because obviously they've impacted each other to such a degree that they obviously feel this way, you know. Yeah.
No, I think that's an interesting point, because I think it is really subtle that you could sort of take away, yes, they kissed, but was it that kind of kiss? I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Could they just kiss like that and it still be platonic, perhaps? I don't know.
There's different readings, isn't there?
Yeah,
there's
different
readings,
sure,
of this. There's different levels of it. That you can take it as a beautifully shot film. Mm. You can enjoy it as a comedy. Mm. You can enjoy it. A friend of mine said, I won't come and watch it because it's a rom-com.
Right.
I said, I don't think it's a rom-com.
No, it's not a rom-com.
So, but it's interesting that someone could have that opinion, that it's a rom-com. Okay. Yeah.
No, I think that's definitely... Well, we all bring ourselves to the text, don't we, I suppose. Mm. I think that's just about it. We've run out of time. You've got to go get your train. Thank you very much for coming all this way, Melody. Thank you very much to everyone for coming. Thanks to the guys for taping. And hopefully we'll be back soon, James, at the keynote for another session of The Cinematologist. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
So a really interesting discussion there, and perhaps one of the more contentious screenings, amazingly. I mean, I didn't really expect it to have that kind of effect. I thought there would be a lot of agreement on this, but it was really great that we had these sort of different points of view coming out about how the film should be read and what films should be doing. So what was your take, Neil?
Yeah, really, you know, first of all, it was a new venue. So to have that kind of a really broad, deep discussion at a new venue was great. And it's a film that when I was rewatching it, I thought there was, you know, sort of five or six things that I really wanted to kind of say. And it was interesting to see that how many different responses there were to it. And it reminded me that it is a kind of Marmite film. It is a very subjective experience, I think. I think it kind of approaches the audience in that way. There is an element of what you bring to it that needs to be kind of taken into account. And I think that starting point is important in terms of how you would read or engage with the film. In terms of kind of where to start with it, it's like, I don't really know. I mean, that opening shot is to me, and always was the first time I saw it, a provocation of starting a film with that very lascivious direct image from a female filmmaker. It always felt very provocative in terms of like, daring people to kind of to view it in a certain way. But then I never really realized that this may be stretching it, but it kind of struck me is that the next image is of Bill Murray asleep, and then the film plays out in this dream state. You have this Kevin Shields score, which is really dreamy and ethereal. You know, he's never really awake, Bill Murray, you know, and nothing is real. You know, there's no, even the what you were sort of talking about, the authentic representations of, you know, that kind of the Japanese culture, you know, the TV show that we see that he goes to, you know, the arcade that they go to, all that, that's purposely not real. And then the Japanese characters that come in out of the film are clearly not real and feel very racist. But I don't know if that's stretching it, but it kind of struck me as if it feels like it takes place in a in a kind of dream space, which I don't think excuses its problems at all, but I just thought it was an interesting way of seeing the film. And then when you were sort of talking about that, it is all about Bill Murray's character, you know, and it almost is him having this kind of ideal breakaway in, you know, is Scarlett Johansson even a real character? She's not a real person in terms of a fully developed character, but is she just someone that his character wants to engage with in this kind of purgatory away from his wife, which I thought was kind of an interesting way to read the film. I don't know if you've got anything to kind of respond to on that before I carry on. Or...
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an interesting one because, again, that argument came up, didn't it, about how is Scarlett Johansson's character underdeveloped, or is this how Sofia Coppola felt about herself in this moment, that she's an underdeveloped person? And again, I think, you know, that was one of the sort of contentions that me and Melody had, where, you know, at the age of 21, how fully developed are we as people? And there isn't really a lot of sympathy for, you know, it's difficult to have sympathy for Scarlett Johansson, you know, quite rightly. And seeing one of her later films Somewhere this afternoon, you have even less sympathy for the kind of Hollywood bubble that this character is in. But yeah, it's a difficult one. But it was really interesting how all the younger people in the audience seemed to identify with Scarlett Johansson's character, and they wouldn't have it. They wouldn't have it at all that she was underdeveloped. So it does seem to fit perfectly with that millennial sense of being almost in a that idea of the Western young people have almost a version of that around them. I mean, obviously in that film, it's a heightened. You know, she's got this famous husband, she's in this hotel, they're in Japan, they've got lots of money, all of that kind of stuff. But I think the sort of Western affluence that most, you know, that a lot of people experience, they have a version of that and they still feel lost within it. So I think that's where the identification lies. Now, from the outside, I think it's perfectly reasonable to sort of say, oh, grow up, get over yourself as a kind of reaction to that. And I think that's what some of the problems of Sofia Coppola's later films, where you're just kind of like, I just don't care about you as a character. You've got it all, you know, why are you moaning so much?
Yeah, and I think that's a credit to the performers, Johansson and Bill Murray. I think rewatching it, I thought there's an immediacy to the film, which kind of makes it feel very in the moment, but felt underdeveloped. And it felt like they, you know, it was interesting that, you know, talking about the writing and the screenplay, and I don't feel like it has a screenplay. I feel like that much of what happens that we see on screen is the product of Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson. And I think that there's a gap between their abilities as improvisers, because, you know, and I know obviously he kind of delivered a lot of the dialogue himself, you know, just kind of making it up. And it feels like they've gone to Japan with characters and scenarios, and they found places to film, and they filmed stuff there. And that's what I really liked about it, because it gives it an immediacy of, it doesn't feel bogged down, like, even though the characters are kind of unsympathetic, because it feels like that the creation of the film has kind of allowed that immediacy to evolve. And I think that's also a flaw, because some of the scenes are quite wooden and quite difficult, particularly, you know, in the early parts of the film. And I think that Bill Murray is very, very good at kind of retreating into himself and giving a nuanced performance, which suggests depth in a way that maybe Johansson at that period in her career was not great at. And I think if you look at someone like Under the Skin, she's incredible at it. That's just what happens when you're a really talented actor who works a lot and hard across, you know. And I think it would be a different film if she was making that film now. The question of sympathy, just before you sort of, you know, is like, there's always been films about the bourgeoisie, and there's always been films about the, you know, the middle class and the upper class, and it's a mode of particularly, you know, American kind of filmmaking, and there are way too many films about sad white men, but this is the age we live in, and we want cinema to reflect, you know, the society and where the society's at and what the society's engaged with. And, you know, in this century, there has been a real angst-ridden analysis of from you know, the entitlement class, you know. And I think that while I don't want every film to do it, I think that we do need films which represent all aspects of society, and this is an interesting film in the way it does it a lot of the time, but also sometimes it doesn't quite work for me. Yeah,
What did you make of the points at the end about the final scene and the kiss between the two of them? Because obviously, again, that was another disagreement kind of in the discussion.
I absolutely forgot that they kissed. Really? Yeah, absolutely. Wow. And I'm absolutely with Melody on it. It feels out of place. I was thinking about it was that this whisper, you know, has kind of gone into film legend now. That what does he say to her at the end of the film? And obviously his kind of refusal to talk about it, and this kind of private moment, you know, which is a private moment in such a voyeuristic experience, always kind of piques the interest, I think. And I think it's masterfully played that I completely forgotten that they kissed. For me, the end of the film is him whispering and then him getting in the car. It absolutely blanked it out. And watching it again, I was like, oh, yeah, it does, because it's such a beautiful moment. And when she pulls away and she's crying, and you don't know what it said, but she's such a great actress, and that is such a real response. You know, that's exactly how it should be left. You know, I think. But then I think if you get, you know, to go back to what I was saying in terms of the way it felt constructed, almost on the go, like they went with an idea. You know, and I think that I was thinking this, like maybe it should be like Scenario by Sofia Coppola, you know, like they used to do in the old days, and Script by Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson, because it feels like they filled in the blanks, and maybe that was a decision they made in the moment, but doesn't necessarily feel like the right one.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that is being read in different ways, as the film is generally. I mean, we'd had some very different comments on Twitter leading up to the episode about how people felt, and I think a lot of people do hold Lost in Translation as a sort of seminal, you know, coming of age film for them in a way, and then other people have just been like, hated it,
yeah,
you know, in a kind of deadpan way.
But I think
but that's,
I think
it's great.
Yeah, and I think that's, again, I think it's very much, to go back to our early episode this year on Memento, you know, those sort of films, if I think that's, we live in that age where of nostalgia and kind of ownership of texts, and if you see a film at a particular time from a particular context, it's going to have a very profound impact. I think Lost in Translation does have the ability to do that.
Well, I think that will just about do it. Thanks very much, Neil. Great to talk to you as usual.
You too, yep. Yeah. And glad to see that you're on the mend.
Yeah, hopefully I'll be in good enough shape to come and present down there a bit later for a Christmas episode, which we'll keep tight-lipped for now, but that's going to be a doozy for sure.
Yeah, that'll be a lot of fun.
But we're next up, it's you and Kingsley.
Yeah, so this week we are screening Penny Baker and Hedges' The War Room, which, you know, seemed like a good idea at the time to kind of dissect objectively, you know, that how close it came to having a Trump presidency. But now I've kind of promoted it as a chance to just vent the fears and anxieties that everyone kind of has. So I think it's a kind of timely chance to show their film about the 1992 presidential campaign. That will be out in a few weeks, I guess, once we've kind of collated that. Got a really good interview lined up that episode as well. In the meantime, you can also check out the Knowing Sounds, which was an experimental podcast we've done for the Journal of Media Practice Disruptive Edition.
Okay, so thank you very much again to the listeners, and until next time, this has been the Cinematologist Podcast. It's humble and fine. They are hilltops at night, they are beautiful, and blazing with light is the whitest and the tallest and